Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, you're going to be hearing from an award-winning actress and playwright who has written a brand new play that premieres this weekend at Carthage, inspired by the story of the civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. In part two, you'll meet an actress who portrays the iconic role of Lieutenant Uhura on the series Star Trek Continues. Stay with us. One of the most impressive accomplishments of the Carthage Theater Department over the last decade or so has been an ongoing project called the New Play Initiative, in which Carthage has reached out to some of the country's most acclaimed playwrights. Figures like Eric Simonson, Jeffrey Hatcher, or Karadad Zvich, and established collaborative relationships with them. 8 new plays have been written expressly for the Carthage Theater Department, and the 9th new play is about to open on the stage of the Wartburg Auditorium this weekend. It's called A Seat at the Table. It is written by a very talented woman by the name of Regina Taylor, both a wonderful actress and writer. You may know her for her work in such films as Lean on Me, Courage Under Fire, Losing Isaiah, Clockers, or for her work on television on series such as The Unit or I'll Fly Away. She has the distinction of being the first black woman to play the role of Juliet on Broadway. She has ongoing relationships with the Goodman Theater of Chicago and the Signature Company in New York City. Her many plays that she has written include Magnolia, the Trinity River Plays, and the musical Crowns. This new play written for Carthage is titled A Seat at the Table, and it was inspired by the incredible story of a civil rights activist by the name of Fannie Lou Hamer. In many respects, a very ordinary woman who came out of a family of sharecroppers, but who went on to be one of the most distinctive and compelling voices of the civil rights era. Again, the play A Seat at the Table will be opening this weekend at Carthage College. Here's a portion of my conversation with its playwright, Regina Taylor. So tell us, first of all, how you first became connected with Carthage College and became aware of this opportunity. Just tell us how this collaboration began.
Martin McClendon reached out to me saying that they would like to commission me for a new piece. We met in Chicago, we talked, and I said, absolutely would be interested. I really love working with students. And I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to write specifically for a group of people.
Tell us a bit about your career and the fact that, if I understand correctly, you began as a performer, as an actor, and
I've always written. I've been writing since I was a child, maybe 4 or 5 years old, writing children's books. My mother set her hand on mine, helping me to do that. It was the greatest gift that she gave me, the opportunity, the daring to create images of oneself, to take in the world and give your perspective of what you're seeing in the world, to be able to name yourself in this world. Wonderful tools for a young African-American child to have in this world. So I started out as a writer, went to school thinking I would be a journalist, and took an acting class and fell in love with that.
So in a sense, it is the reverse of how it might appear, at least on paper, or as we glance at your resume, for instance. Tell us what prompted your powerful interest in acting and what that journey was like.
It was to get an easy A to fill out some credits for college. That's what my counselor told me. And was wonderful for me as a very introverted person to be able to stand on stage and claim my own voice, to be able to take these journeys through different lives, different people, seeing how we're the same and how we're different, to come back from those experiences expanded as a human being, hopefully, to be able to see clearer the world and myself, to be a servant to the work as an actress. And then I started writing plays out of the acting is when I started taking another route in terms of creating. Also then that led me to directing.
Hmm. Tell us what it was like to be writing in this new arena, that is playwriting, versus the writing that you had done earlier, which I didn't know anything about until you mentioned it now, but writing children's books, not an entirely different thing, and yet in some ways quite a different artistic undertaking. Just how different were they, and how difficult was it for you to become comfortable with playwriting?
It's about, I think it's just about the technique of it. It's a different way of putting it on the page, but it's always about the story, how to capture that story. And the stories come out of questions that I have about the world, questions in the questioning, these stories, these characters take shape.
How typically have your new plays taken shape? That is, the various collaborations that you have done with places like, for instance, the Goodman Theater in Chicago, that many of our listeners are well acquainted with, or the Signature Theater and other entities. I mean, typically, how do projects take shape?
Usually someone comes and says, would you like to write something for us? And usually I say yes. and then I start thinking about what I'd like to follow. I have like trunk loads of ideas already, and it's really about making the time to figure it out and put it on the page.
So typically a project begins with that open-ended an invitation. Would you write a play for us about anything?
Yes,
essentially
about anything. Yes. Absolutely. And then you figure out what you're passionate about, what really is on your mind. And with this, A Seat at the Table, it came out of this past year and a half, just the world turning upside down and around and back again, and then another direction. Seeing what was happening in the United States in terms of politics then led me to Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer being this absolutely amazing activist, fighter for voter rights, activist, who came into the American spotlight in 1964 with the Democratic Convention when she demanded a seat at the table for herself and the delegates of the integrated delegation, as opposed to the segregated delegates who were being seated by Lyndon B. Johnson. It was who has a voice, who is legitimate, and she was there front and center.
Hmm. One of the things, of course, that is so striking about the story of Fannie Lou Hamer is not just how eloquently and captivatingly she spoke in that moment and in many occasions thereafter, but also that impact was even greater when one knew her own background as the youngest of 20 children and coming out of a family of sharecroppers. Tell us more about her own life journey that led her to that momentous occasion in 1964 and all of the other work that she did.
Yes, born in Mississippi, sharecropper, 19 siblings, mother and father. She married and thought she was going to have a lot of children, and unknowingly they sterilized her because it was the law in Mississippi at the time that you could sterilize poor African-American women without them having a say. She came into the civil rights movement when people were registering people to vote. She didn't know she had that right until then. She then tried registering to vote, did not pass the test that was required. There was a test and a tax you had to pay, but it was, you had to, sometimes it was to explain the Constitution, understand its meaning, to be able to write it, to read it, and to explain the Constitution might be a test before you would pay and then be able to vote. She didn't pass that test the first time, and when she went back to the plantation where she lived, the owner of the plantation told her she would need to stop doing this or she would have to leave her home 18 years. She refused to back down, and she had to leave her family behind, her husband and her two adopted children, because she refused to not give up her dream to vote. She was embraced by SNCC, putting her front and center at a lot of the meetings as a kind of piper for people to sign on, someone like her, grassroots, putting their lives on the line to vote. It was then that they started forming, they had the idea to form a group that would register people outside of the Jim Crow segregated system and create their own party and register as many African Americans as possible. But around that time, Mississippi was almost half African American. So if they got enough people to vote, they could have their own mayor, governor, et cetera. So this was very empowering because they knew if the numbers were great enough, if they stuck together, then they would be in a powerful position for either party, either the Democrats or the Republicans, because at that time the nation was split down the middle, and they could then tip the scales. They would be a very powerful entity. They then put that delegation together, went to Atlantic City, where the convention was being held, and told Lyndon B. Johnson, we should be seated instead of the Mississippi segregated delegates. And LBJ was in a spot because because he didn't want to lose the South by seeming to cater to African Americans. That's where the story is. It begins is that 1964 convention.
So a seat at the table tells us about that particular moment in Mrs. Hamer's life.
It begins there, and then we go back to her very humble beginnings to see how she got there. In 1964, it would seem that she did not win that quest of having integrated delegates. And I like the story having to deal with that. How do you deal with what seems to be a loss? What have you gained? And how do you continue on in that next time, the next convention, she is seated.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Regina Taylor, responsible for a brand new play about to open at Carthage College called A Seat at the Table, inspired by the story of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. And it focuses in particular on that dramatic moment during the 1964 Democratic convention. Explain to our listeners that maddening decision that then-President Lyndon Baines Johnson did that, in effect, not exactly silenced Fannie Lou Hamer, but deprived the wider American public from being able to watch her as she testified. Explain what he did and what kind of impact you think that had.
Yes, the delegates had to present their case to be recognized and to be seated during that convention. It was the segregated party or the desegregated party, Daniel Haynes delegates, who should be seated. So they had to testify. There were several people that testified, including Martin Luther King, and including Fannie Lou Hamer. It seems that Lyndon B. Johnson was more afraid of Fannie Lou Hamer speaking than Martin Luther King Jr. Speaking, Dr. Martin Luther King, that when they were presented to testify broadcast live to the nation, Lyndon B. Johnson interrupted the broadcast when Fannie Lou Hamer got up to speak. And he interrupted it for this special announcement, and they thought he was going to announce who his running mate was going to be. Instead, he announced the 9-month anniversary of Connally being shot along with JFK. And they went, well, that's not a reason to interrupt a broadcast. Why? Became the question. And the answer was, he did want to silence her. And that became the story. So they rebroadcast her that evening on the evening news. And that's how so many people got to know her, got to know her story.
Can you just say a word about what she was like as a communicator? I suspect quite a few of our listeners, but I suspect not all of our listeners, have seen the footage of this extraordinary testimony which she delivers in 1964. I still remember what a powerful impact it had on me when I watched it on the documentary series Eyes on the Prize.
Yeah.
But for someone who does not know the face and the voice and the inflection of Fannie Lou Hamer, just say a word about her really powerful eloquence.
She was a powerhouse. She was called the voice of the civil rights movement. She would be on these marches, and she would share her songs. These were spirituals that had been converted into protest songs. She was a powerful speaker. Her testimony was raw. It was real. It came from the soil of the Mississippi Delta. She told the story of her life in a really impactful way. She was very loud. Everyone said she was very loud, was very distinctive, but she was very truthful, honest. And what she talked about, and just in terms of wanting to be a full, whole citizen of these United States of America, with the right to vote, to have your voice up in there, deciding who should represent, and the power that that brings to self and communities, was very strong as an African-American woman in the times that she lived in. What she did is staggering, putting her life on the line. And it was. At one point, she was taken into jail because she was registering people to vote, and they beat her within an inch of her life. She could barely move. Once she finally got out of that jail, had several months to recover from that beating, and she got back up, and she kept marching, and she kept telling her truth.
I don't know if we have yet talked about one of the most disturbing moments in Fannie Lou Hamer's life, which occurs several years before her dramatic appearance at the Democratic National Convention. And I think it so vividly speaks to the times in which she lived and the degradation that was so often a part of poor African Americans living in the South. I'm speaking of what happened as she had surgery done in 1961, and had something done to her at the time without her consent by her white doctor. Can you say a word about that? And I'm curious also if this is a mentioned at all in A Seat at the Table.
Oh, yes, absolutely. When she sterilized without her consent, because it was law in Mississippi to you had the right to sterilize poor African-American women, they had no say.
It really says something. I mean, for somebody living in America now, who looking back over that chasm of time, who might not really fully understand what it meant to be a black in Mississippi in 1961, it seems to me that what Fannie Lou Hamer suffered, this indignity at this moment in her life, capsulizes as much as any single moment can. What that era talks.
You have no rights in terms of your own body. It is a time of Jim Crow laws. It is a time where African Americans are not seen as fully human and with the full rights of American citizens. It is a time when people are standing up and placing their lives on the line to make a change. It is a time when the nation is divided down the middle. Who are we going to vote for to represent our ideas of which way this democracy should go? It is a time that feels all too familiar at this moment in time. And that's why I was very excited to write it and to share it with the students, one, who do not know this history. And as they are looking at which way they might go, in this political climate, it's important that we do know this history as we're trying to steer our direction forward.
I know you have been to Carthage at least a couple of times since agreeing to create this new play for the Carthage Theater Department. Tell us about the visits that you have paid to the campus and the personal connection that you have forged, at least to some extent, with the young people who are in your cast.
Yes, it's been really interesting to me working with the students who are learning this history for the first time. They play a range. Each student plays a range of characters, both older and young, from someone playing a brother to Fanning Hamer, to playing Medgar Evers, to playing someone that works for Martin Luther King, to different ages, and it is a multicultural cast because we think of black and white issues, and we don't look around to beyond black and white. One student, it was very interesting, he was saying that because we also deal with the slaying of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman during Freedom Summer, who were freedom riders on the bus taken and killed that summer. So one of the young men was saying, this guy is my age. And they chose to take their summer to take this ride on the bus, knowing that they could be killed. And they did that for what they believed in. And he questioned, well, would I do that? He had to question himself. It is about a questioning of what Fannie Lou Hamer did, was she questioned America. She dared to question America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, this place that she loved and knew that she was willing to stand up, speak, dare, lay her life on the line for implementing some changes that needed to happen. So the students are looking at that. It is, this play has music of the period, protest music from Sam Cooke to Bob Dylan. It is a piece about resistance. It is a piece about questioning who you are in this moment of 1964, but also questioning who we are at this moment in time.
Will you be able to be at Carthage for any of the performances?
Yes, I do plan to.
Very good. Well, I know people are excited indeed about this play and now the opportunity to also to meet you and perhaps hear from you. The play, A Seat at the Table, is opening this weekend at Carthage College, and its playwright, Regina Taylor. Regina Taylor, I was deeply honored to speak with you. Thank you so much, and we wish you very, very well with all you go on to create from here. And thank you again for being part of today's morning show.
And thank you so much. Thank you for your support.
And for more information about these performances of A Seat at the Table by Regina Taylor, you can go to the Carthage website, carthage.edu. Click on the bridge, and you will very easily find a full story about A Seat at the Table, and that will also include a link to where you can arrange tickets. We're approaching 8:40. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. And here's part two.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Just about the entire world knows those iconic words and that iconic music by Alexander Courage, but that is not the voice of William Shatner, because this is actually not the opening to Star Trek, the original series, but rather the opening to a marvelous web series called Star Trek Continues, which we have talked about before on The Morning Show. And I'm really excited to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking with one of the actors who is part of Star Trek Continues, which is widely regarded as the finest of all fan series, fan-produced sequels to Star Trek, the original series. There are several of them that have been created to varying degrees of success, but Star Trek Continues is the real gold standard for the relentless attention to detail that they have wanted to achieve in terms of the visual look of the show and the dramatic flow of the stories and so on. In the iconic role of Lieutenant Uhura at the communication stations is an actress by the name of Kim Stinger, who happens to be a friend of WGTD's own Jim McClure. So it's through that connection of friendship that I'm able to connect with Kim Stinger today and talk with her about the experience of stepping into the shoes of actress Nichelle Nichols to portray one of the most famous roles on television, particularly for African-American women. Kim Stinger, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I really appreciate it. Thanks to both you and to Jim for the opportunity.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. We should find out just a little bit about your life aside from Star Trek, which we'll get to in just a moment. You say on your website that you have a head for business and a heart for art, and you have lived a life in which you have, in a sense, a foot in each of those worlds. Tell us about that balancing act.
It's true. It's an interesting dichotomy. I grew up with an older brother who was a wholehearted artist, and he passed away when I was a junior in high school. And I think the impact that he had on me at that young age was, he always encouraged me to be more creative and to explore the arts. I remember the high school play was coming around, and he was, you know, one of my staunchest supporters to encourage me to go for it. And while I was one of those kids who was an achiever in school, and my mindset naturally kind of went that way, I think that when he passed, there was kind of a switch that went off in my mind that really just embraced the importance and I think a realization of the importance of both. And so my career has been pretty interesting in the sense that I've always done something that was either creative in a business world or business-like in a creative world. So my very first job out of college, for example, I was a writer and editor at Hallmark Cards, and I was a creative person in that world. And then when we had some great success in an area, I realized that all of the people that they were bringing in to lead the business, you know, the work that we were doing, were business people. And they were doing things that I kind of had a mind for. So I decided to go back to school and get my MBA and got my MBA in marketing, and then started working at Disney as a marketing person in the creative world of Disney. So it's always been kind of an interesting balancing act. And when I decided to pursue acting wholeheartedly, I did it with the mindset of a business person in trying to build my career. But at the same time, I think the art I'm realizing more and more that the purpose behind either has to be greater than than the output itself. Mm-hmm. And so if I could kind of merge those two things in line with a greater purpose, then that, I think, will be the ideal.
Hmm. So you have a resume that includes a number of things, including The Bold and the Beautiful and America's Most Wanted. But, of course, we want to talk primarily about the fact that you are on this, shall we call it, a fan-created sequel called Star Trek Continues that takes up where Star Trek, the original series, left off and, in a sense, filling in the gap, those years between the end of the original series and the beginning of the motion pictures. It's been so fun to follow this series thus far. Explain how you made the connection and landed the role of Lieutenant Uhura. And ahead of that, have you always been a Star Trek fan, or was this, in a sense, just one more acting role for you?
Well, I can tell you, initially, it was an acting role. I mean, I grew up with uncles and cousins who were very, very much into Star Trek. I'm from a family of a lot of engineers, and they were very much into Star Trek, so it was always on. But I really was, I was kind of under my grandmother used to keep me during the day, and I would be kind of with her watching the stories, the soap operas, while my uncles were watching Star Trek. And, but I do remember one of my uncles saying, you could look like her one day. And I looked up at the screen and I saw this beautiful, this beautiful woman, Michelle Nichols. And I didn't know what she was doing. I just know that she looked so glamorous. I remember just being overwhelmed by how pretty she was and how she wasn't doing anything. Like, she was doing something that everybody else on the screen was doing. It was she belonged there. And so when the opportunity came up to audition for another Star Trek production, I did and landed that role. And during the course of that production, I always say I'm not lucky, I'm blessed. I was really blessed to meet and interact with Vic Mignogna, who I know has been on your show, and he is the creator and executive producer of Star Trek Continues and our Captain Kirk, and he's one of those people who definitely has a head for business and a heart for art, and we just kind of vibed, and we just had a great time working together, and when he invited me to come play Lieutenant Uhura, I was, first of all, floored and honored, and then the chance to work with him was just too good to pass up.
Right.
And I'm so glad I didn't.
Right. So tell us what it is like to have an assignment like this where it is a character that so many people know. It would be interesting to pose this question to all of your castmates as well, but to what extent are you trying to do this role the same way Nichelle Nichols did this role versus just trying to do the role as you feel equipped to do it yourself within your own skin? How have you handled that sort of intriguing question or challenge?
I have to say, at the onset, I just wanted to be credible in the role. I couldn't, it was too much pressure to feel like, oh, my gosh, I have to be like Michelle. Michelle is a triple threat, first of all. I don't have the talent to be Michelle in this role, and she created the role. So what I wanted to do was bring the essence of who I believed Uhura to be. I think, personally, Uhura is the heart of the ship. She's a compassionate warrior, and so I tried to emulate that aspect of her and kind of bring that forward in the way that my body naturally reacts to do that, in the way that my sensibilities can kind of digest and transmit that. But I have to say, the very first episode at the premiere of our very first episode, so the very first public showing of it, Nichelle Nichols sat right beside me.
Wow.
I thought, oh my gosh, please like it, please like it, please like it the entire time. It was such an honor for her to be there, first of all, but it was so intimidating, and I just wanted to do it justice. And as gracious as she is, and anyone who has interacted with her, who's listening to your show knows she is so amazing and so wonderful and warm. And she just embraced it. She embraced me. She embraced the show. And she got on the microphone that day and gave us verbal support for what we were doing. And we all felt a little bit blessed her to say, hey, you're on the right road. So,
That had to be thrilling. Here is a little excerpt from one of the episodes, just so our listeners can hear you in action as Lieutenant Uhura.
Captain, reading additional damage on an internal bulkhead.
Deck 4?
Yes, sir. Aft wall, section 3.
Captain, now deck 5 is reporting a rupture. In the ceiling, sir.
Signal all decks. We've been boarded.
All decks, intruder alert. Repeat, we have an intruder on board. Repeat, all decks, intruder alert. We have an intruder on board.
You know, it's interesting. One of the challenges that I've always thought a lot about, both with the original actors and the original series, and you folks in what you're doing now, is the challenge of sitting in front of, in a sense, what is all fake equipment, and making it feel real to us as the viewer, that you're really sitting in front of a control panel, and then when you're pressing these buttons and listening to this headphone, that you're hearing things, actually hearing things and doing things, and that it's real, that it's authentic. And I've always thought that, first of all, the actors in the original series were really good at that. And I think those of you that are on Star Trek Continues are also doing a really, really great job of making what we're seeing seem plausible and authentic. Can you say a word about that challenge?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. I think that the cast and the crew on our show are so amazingly talented. The people that Vic brought to this production are all people who are talented in their own right in terms of working as actors or working as actually creating things in as directors or as a cameraman or, you know, doing things professionally, but who also had either a love for him, a love for Trek, or a love for both, and decided to come and participate. So everyone takes their job very seriously, and we have people on set who are, you know, they are sticklers for making sure that, you know, oh, this light is supposed to light up when you hit this button, or this is, you know, whenever Uhura puts on the comm, this is the button that she would always push, and then this thing would happen. So it was very helpful to have people who were advisors who were so into the show that they could tell you this is what is, you know, this is consistent throughout canon.
Right.
As to what should happen.
Good point.
But then there's also that spirit that everyone brings to it. Because, no, the earpiece wasn't functioning in my ear, but as we're in these heated, you know, battles on set and the way that everyone's delivering their line with this amping up kind of thing, feeling and, you know, the there's a certain element of passion and fire that's happening, and you just kind of get involved in it and get engulfed in it, and it feels like, yes, the ship just got hit. And we're reeling now. It's kind of fun, actually. It's playing Star Trek,
right,
at the highest level.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have to say too that one thing that I deeply appreciate about Star Trek Continues, and in this aspect, I like it more than the original series, which seems like heresy to say, but I so appreciate the fact that that great attention is given to the supporting players. That we see a lot of you. And it's clear that that those who have created this sequel and are crafting these scripts and so on care about all of the characters, and not just the big three of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but Scotty and Sulu and Chekhov and Uhura. And I've always thought that Star Trek was at its best when all of the characters are richly represented.
Yeah, I think the original series, In all honesty, I think they never had time to get there, you know, in their three short seasons, and then they're gone. I think the desire was always, because I can't imagine why Gene Roddenberry would have assembled such a luscious cast of people. I mean, such an intriguing group, and not want to explore those things. And after the series was on, and there was, you know, it was just kind of, it was in syndication with just those three seasons, I think there were a lot of natural questions that arose among the fans to say, hey, I wonder about, you know, this aspect, or what was it like to be on this ship for a 5-year mission, and their, you know, how does that affect their interpersonal relationship? I think there's a great scene. Well, there are a lot of great scenes, but I think I felt the impact of that when we were in a, you know, in a very dangerous situation, and you're looking at crew members that you realize your character has lived with for the last 5 years, and has you know owes her life to you in many instances, because this person saved her, or this person did this thing to save the ship. And when that dramatic temperature amps up, all of those feelings come to the surface. So to have the chance to express that was really an honor. Mm. And I'm hoping that the fans really do get the sense that we're seeing a more complete version of the entire group, because I think that was one of the goals.
Right. Last question. When the original series aired, you've already talked about the impact that a role like Lieutenant, a character like Lieutenant Uhura had on many people watching the series, and particularly young African Americans, how thrilling to see a bridge full of skillful officers, and there was an African American among them, and a woman among them. Do you feel like we still live in a world where a character like Lieutenant Uhura serves that kind of function and is important in that way?
I absolutely do. I think we're living in a world where there are many firsts, there are many pioneers. There are people who are, whatever you represent, whether it's a racial minority, whether, you know, it's a religion, whether, and it could just be unique to you. I mean, it doesn't have to be something that we see outwardly. It could just be who you feel you are inside. In many cases, you're going to be the first. You're the only you, so you're going to be the first you to accomplish anything. And I think what Lieutenant Uhura does, and seminal characters like her, is it gives us permission to be brave in being exactly who we are within that setting, within this environment. I bring a new voice to the table that has not been heard before, no matter who I am. And I deserve to be heard.
Hmm.
And so I really respect that.
Kim Stinger portrays Lieutenant Uhura in the series Star Trek Continues. And you can view episodes of Star Trek Continues on their website or on YouTube. And Kim Stinger, what a pleasure and honor for me to speak with you. And I wish you very, very well in all of your future endeavors. Thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about one of the great towering masterpieces of American theater, Streetcar Named Desire by Tennessee Williams. We'll be talking with Brian Gill, a member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Their production of Streetcar Named Desire is opening this weekend. On Thursday's program, among other things, you'll hear my conversation with Christine Baker Klein, the author of one of the best novels I have ever read called A Piece of the World, which tells the story of the real-life friendship between painter Andrew Wyeth and the woman depicted in one of his most famous paintings called Christina's World. And on Friday, Peyson Williams, who is an alum of the